You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, April 9th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, why live to tape? Because there's no live show today. Why no live show today? Because I'm still on vacation. Yeah, can you believe it? That's almost 3 or 4 days of vacation, even though we're working like triple days to give you shows this week. God, you just take. It's like my kids. Just like Michael. Just takes. Michael's job, apparently, is just to come here and, I don't know, make tea for himself. That's what Michael's job's description. He wrote up his own job description. Make tea. Store my yoga pants. Yeah, that's what happens, Michael, when you're not here and you allow me to pre-record these openings without you. I make a joke about you. That's what you get. So,
I mean, it's no different than if he was here. But
that's true. Matt has got a good point. So fair enough, folks. We got a great show for you today. Joan Fitzgerald, professor of urban policy and public affairs at Northeastern, on why markets can't price the priceless, about water, about the lack of it in the Southwest, in the West, and too much of it in the Northeast. Why it's happening, what can be done about it, what problems it portends. Also, then we will speak to Adam Green, co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, on a new initiative they've got going. And you know they're one of my favorite organizations. I mean, in terms of organizing, they're fantastic, I think. They've had... One day we'll sit back and we'll just sort of like... really try and quantify the successes they've had. But I think it's a little bit early to do that. There's been plenty. Then for members, Jose Rivera, the writer and director of the Motorcycle Diaries. This is a deep archive for members only show where Janine and I interviewed Jose Rivera. When the Motorcycle Diaries came out about 10 years ago, this is, of course, Che Guevara's Motorcycle Diaries. I don't know if I left this in the clip, but I made a joke that leading up to his introduction, that he had plagiarized the whole thing because it was obviously based on Che Guevara's diaries. I mean, so it was a joke. And I don't think Janine took very well to that joke. So there's plenty of, like, if you're one of those old fans who likes the when Janine beats me up on air, that's it there. There it is. So that's the show we have for you today. Enjoy it. We've got another one for you tomorrow, a great one tomorrow as well. I'm not looking forward to it because I actually already experienced it. But you should be looking forward to it because it's great, and I know I've experienced that. All right, folks, enjoy this show. Oh, just remember, free shipping, justcoffee.coop, COOP.coop, justcoffee. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. This is the time for you to try out the coffee. And you should do it now because I'm telling you something. You're going to want to get more. And you might as well get more during the month where they had the free shipping. Because they've never done this before. As far as I know, they'll never do it again. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Try the Majority Report blend. Give it as a gift. This is the time to do that. And I guess you could maybe deliver it to yourself and then give it as like a, I don't know, Christmas gift. That would be a little bit long to wait, I think, probably. But also, if you want to become a member of the show, support the program, go to majority.fm, become a member. All right, folks, enjoy the show. We'll have a new one for you tomorrow and then back live on Monday. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Joan Fitzgerald, professor of urban and public policy at the School for Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University. And we are talking about the piece in the American Prospect, Why Markets Can't Price the Priceless. Welcome to the program, Joan.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So your piece about why we cannot price, ultimately, water, or why in and of itself the market cannot set the price for water, struck me as very timely for a couple of reasons. I mean, one, we talk quite a bit about the idea of the free market being able to do things more efficiently than government on this program. We find that in many aspects it's horribly lacking to the extent that a free market actually exists. But beyond that, too, water is increasingly becoming a real problem. Massive drought out in California, and it is becoming more and more of a problem. So tell us where water is a problem and in what way.
Well, one of the things we know about climate change is that dry areas are going to get drier, wet areas are going to get wetter. And what we need to do in that environment is price water correctly, but for different reasons. So just to clarify, I didn't say that we shouldn't price water, but I said I don't think we need to privatize the provision of water. And so the two examples I cited were two of the extremes. One in Las Vegas, where the Water Authority had various programs. So in urban policy, we call them carrots and sticks. So programs to help people consume less water, and businesses consume less water, incentives for them to do that, but then pricing mechanisms so that rather than the more you use, it gets cheaper, the more you use, it gets more expensive. So that's kind of the strategy that's the pricing strategy that's embraced around using less water. The example I used on pricing in the article is on Philadelphia, which, like many East Coast cities, has the problem of having to meet stormwater management requirements, not putting water into streams, oceans, lakes, waterways, and
I want to make that distinction because I found that really interesting. I wasn't sort of like aware of that potential dilemma. So you have southwestern cities and I guess west coast or western cities where you've got a lack of water, and then east coast cities where you've got too much, and that brings us to Philadelphia. I mean, just tell us about that notion of runoff, because I didn't, I just assumed, I guess, well, it rains a lot and it'll go in the sewer and that's it. That's the end of the story, but it's not.
Yeah. Well, it's not too much water per se, but it's in the entire Northeast, the amount of rainwater. So not only the number of storms, so we have the frequency of storms and the severity of storms increasing. Okay, and many of our older cities have in a good majority of their area what's called a combined water and sewer system. So what happens? All the water from, you know, your housing and businesses goes into that sewer system, but so does all the rainwater in those areas. And then what happens when you get a flooding event, a Hurricane Sandy, a prolonged rain, it backs up. The system can't handle it. So there's two ways you can solve that problem. One is build more what's called gray infrastructure, and that is you just pipe it away. And that's what we've done for, you know, almost a century, and we're finding that it's not effective, but it still backs up a lot of water into people's houses, into riverways. So the Clean Water Act makes cities stop doing that in terms of pollution. So you can either build a bigger tunnel underground, or you can start working with green infrastructure, which is what Philadelphia did. But that was accompanied, just like Las Vegas, it wasn't just one measure, there was pricing. And similarly in Philadelphia. So how water is traditionally priced is based on how much you use. And that does not cover the cost of maintaining the system. And so what happens is all that stormwater, nobody's paying for it. So Philadelphia it wasn't the first city, but it was the first city that did it as extensively, started charging people by the amount of impervious surface. So essentially the amount of stormwater runoff that their property created. And so that was the stick, because people, you know, businesses who hadn't been charged before, say you've got a Walmart, you've got that huge parking lot creating all kinds of runoff, but you're only paying a very small water bill for whatever is used in the store. So that's a big stick, but they created these programs where if the businesses made investments in green infrastructure to handle their stormwater, then their bill was reduced by the amount they did.
So we have a classic case of looking to, and it's, we're talking mostly about sort of corporations in this situation, right? Because your average homeowner doesn't have a huge plot of land that's paved over for no reason. Water gets absorbed into the ground more. But this is paying for that externality. Your parking lot will tax. And by that I mean put pressure on the water infrastructure that we all have to pay with our tax dollars, and you're getting a free ride there, basically.
Exactly. And but you know, it's interesting. You mentioned residential uses. So one of the things that they want to do is have people use rain barrels more on their property. Well, the zoning code prevented that. Because all, you know, runoff had to go directly into the sewer. So what Philadelphia found was they had to change zoning regulations. A lot of things had to change in their systems, regulatory systems, to accommodate this green infrastructure. But it's the first city in the country that's attempting to meet these EPA guidelines, Clean Water Act guidelines, completely with green infrastructure mechanisms.
And how is that working? I mean, are we seeing the Walmarts repaving? I guess that's what's involved, right? They repave the parking lot with something that will is somewhat permeable, and so water can drip into it. Is that it?
That's one green stormwater technique to replace with permeable pavement where it's possible. There's bioswales where you build natural areas where they're just gardens, but then they can fill up with water and gradually drain, as the stormwater recedes. So there's rain barrels, various canals that can be put in parks, and it's a real experiment. They're using all kinds of different techniques and monitoring what they're doing. And for the most part, they've got their Department of Parks on board, their Department of Streets on board, and I think we'll see more cities in the country looking to Philadelphia. Portland, Oregon is another leader in this regard, to see how they're doing it without building this huge gray infrastructure system. And, you know Boston from what you said earlier. One of the problems we have is the whole Back Bay, a good chunk of our city, is landfill.
Total landfill, yes.
Yeah, and so one of the things that's happening when you have a gray pipe infrastructure, the water doesn't rejuvenate that area. And so it's all built on pilings. Those pilings get exposed. And once they're exposed, they start to rot. And so you want to have a system where that water, rather than going through pipes to a main source, treatment source, is actually recirculating to revive the water table.
All right. So before we get to privatization and it being problematic, if I hear what you're saying correctly, on both ends of this, both when we're talking about basically making people account for the runoff that they create, and in the cost for water almost becoming sort of following the model of progressive taxation, right? I mean, this is it's really just basically saying we're exposing the hidden costs that we have been picking up as a society for you, and now you're going to have to pay for it.
Right.
And
yeah, that's right.
And
you know, there was some objection, as you can imagine, at first, and that's why, you know, they created these programs to help them change what they were doing.
Why do you think that is it, or maybe it isn't easier, but I mean, there seems to me to be so many other areas in which we could extend these principles, right? I mean, from a myriad of you know, the entire carbon fuel industry seems to be basically getting a free ride where society picks up the cost of externalities, not the least of which is climate change. But we see examples like this time and time again. Why do you think it's been effective in the realm of water?
Why has it been effective in water?
Yeah, why is it that we've been able to sort of impose these principles in the area of dealing with water in this one part of our infrastructure, but we seem to have so much more problems doing it in other parts of our society?
Well, for starters, I wouldn't say we've been doing it with water. This is one of a handful of cities in the country that's experimenting with this. And it wasn't exactly well received in the beginning because we are used to water as, you know, it's the lowest utility we have, thinking of it as almost a free good and entitlement. I think what we see in the East Coast, though, is that realization that we're in big trouble in terms of, I think Hurricane Sandy was a monumental event. I know in Boston, you know, everyone says, but for a few hours, we would have been high tide as well and would have had these problems. So I think there is a sense of urgency. So unlike, you know, carbon emissions, which, you know, is it from this coal plant, is it from natural gas, water we experience on a day-to-day basis. And so I think it's easier for people to make that connection. They saw what happened with Sandy. They saw what happened in Boston. You know, look at Norfolk, Virginia, look at Miami. I mean, people are seeing the effects of this on a day-to-day basis. And there's a strong realization we have to do something differently.
Indeed. Not so much in Miami, though, it seems to me. But where you have a governor who won't allow the word climate change. But that's not going to stem the water. All right. Well, let's talk about privatization. I mean, give us some examples of where you cite Atlanta, where water privatization has been a failure. What happened with Atlanta?
Well, what happened is they don't make the investments. I mean, there's not that much room because unless you're going to really raise the price, which you can't do because you have to be able to provide some level of water, you can't go in and say, okay, you know, for this price, we're going to give you partially clean water, and for this ultimate price, you get the clean. Everyone gets the same water. And so there's not a lot of room for extracting any extra money out of that system. And so what happens, they get it. I think they probably underestimated the bad condition of the water infrastructure, and that's true in many East Coast cities. And couldn't make the investments, and so the whole system started falling apart. And as I mentioned in the article, there's numerous examples throughout the country of cash-strapped water agencies in cities bringing in privatizers and finding that it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. It doesn't supply clean water, and it doesn't maintain the infrastructure.
It's interesting because my sense, and I don't know if this is the case, but what we witnessed and what we're, I guess, sort of continually witnessing in Detroit is these rapid increases in the price of water, the water rates, the attempts to cut people off from their water. There's some who have speculated, or maybe it's not even that that much of a secret, that the idea is the city raises the rates so it becomes more attractive to private to private entities, so they can come in and make some money off it. I mean, just get how does something like that play into this?
Well, I mean, Detroit is its own case. There's just the state of the budget there. And so what's happened is they let it go for a long time because people couldn't afford to pay their water bill. And again, so they would raise the rate and people see, oh, this is too much. I'm not paying it. They didn't shut people off. And so literally they could not afford to supply water and sewage service. And had to start doing this. So I don't know if it was a deliberate attempt to make it more attractive for privatization as much as just, you know, you can only give water the free ride for so long before it catches up to you.
Indeed. And so in terms of this question of privatizing companies coming in and not realizing sort of or not being prepared to make the infrastructure investments in this. I mean, it's just on some levels, I guess it's sort of a classic case of there are just some jobs that are too big and too, I guess, important in terms of the delivery of the service for it to be functional in private hands.
Right, exactly. And even, you know, when Atlanta did upgrade its infrastructure, I think they had something like 158, I don't quote me, I don't know the exact number, but an astronomical increase in water bills to support that. And I think that's what you're going to see in city after city. If we don't have some kind of federal infrastructure bank that cities can call upon, their only choice is going to be do it by raising rates. And so, you know, the day when water is practically a free good is going to be over very soon.
Joan Fitzgerald, professor of urban and public policy at the School for Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University. The piece is Why Markets Can't Price the Priceless in the American Prospects. I guess it's part of their report, What the Free Market Can't Do. Thanks so much for your time today, Joan.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Ladies and gentlemen, always a pleasure to welcome him back to this program. The Progressive Change Campaign Committee co-founder, Adam Green. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Sam.
How are you doing?
I'm doing
well. Thank you for joining us. Of course, people can check out the PCCC at boldprogressives.org. Adam, I wanted to have you on for two reasons. First, let's start with, and I just want to touch on this briefly because we're going to be playing this. We're recording it 2 days before the runoff election in Chicago, where Chuy Garcia is running in the runoff against Rahm Emanuel. I know that the PCCC has been somewhat involved. I mean, it's a local race, and we don't know what the result is. But, I mean, give me a sense of how this fits in to a larger narrative that you guys have been very involved, and I don't mean to diminish it by saying narrative, because there's a lot of reality to this too, but sort of like organizing this reality of more progressive boldness. Where does this fit in that narrative?
So, you know, the big story with the Chicago mayor's race is really that there is a runoff election, right? The fact that it got to that point shows kind of the white blood cell-like attack that a democratic privatizing corporatist will be under if that's how they govern. This never should have gotten this far for Rahm Emanuel. And I don't think that you'll have someone like Bill de Blasio in the future facing this type of real repulsion by his own electorate in the future. So that's the big story, you know, very similar to Joe Lieberman losing his primary to Ned Lamont back in 2006. The fact that that happened was a story. The fact that that happened is what sent ripple effects throughout the entire Democratic Party, prompting the entire party to change its messaging, in that case on Iraq, in this case on corporate issues, economic populism issues. And what happens in stage two is really kind of the cherry on top. I definitely hope that when this airs, Garcia has won. But if he hasn't, the fact that he got this far really sends a shockwave to all Democratic politicians about the consequences of governing like a corporatist privatizer.
Yeah, the millions of dollars that were that Chuya Garcia would have been outspent is really staggering, and is also sort of indicative of that result. All right. So let's leave that aside, because we don't know what the result of that race is. We can only hope that that Chicagoans came out and voted against Rahm Emanuel for their benefit and ours. But let's talk about this this campaign or program, I'm not sure how you refer to it, Ready for Boldness. What is involved in this?
Well, first, we refer to it as a juggernaut.
Ah, of course.
Yeah. So readyforboldness.com is an initiative that we launched about 2 weeks ago from the time of this airing. And at the time, it was over 200 Iowa and New Hampshire elected officials, political leaders, joining with us on a joint statement that basically said that we want our 2006 Democratic presidential nominee to campaign on big, bold, economic populist ideas. These are ideas like a national goal of debt-free college at all public universities and colleges, expanding Social Security benefits, not cutting them, Wall Street reform, campaign finance reform, something big on jobs and wages, including clean energy jobs, things in those spheres. And it was really remarkable that really kind of the king of Iowa Democratic politics, Tom Harkin, former senator, signed on, his first real political act since retiring last year. Iowa's lone Democratic member of Congress, unfortunately, but he signed on. One of Iowa's two Democratic statewide officials signed on. Over 65 state legislators throughout Iowa and New Hampshire, some former New Hampshire Congress people, and all the way down the ticket, Democratic Party chairs, city council people. It really took it's somewhat an act of courage to project publicly in a field that many people don't currently expect to be too competitive, that we want our nominee to stand on these big, bold, progressive ideas. And what we will be announcing this week at the time of this airing is thousands of public leaders across the nation also joining the cause at readyforboldness.com.
But when you do it in Iowa and New Hampshire, I mean, this is not some real practical implications to this, isn't there?
Yeah. So Iowa and New Hampshire are the first presidential primary and caucus states. Part of Hillary Clinton's strategy will be to, try to have consensus around her enough that nobody wants to jump into the field, or if someone like Martin O'Malley does jump into the field, not giving him political space to grow. And therefore, Iowa and New Hampshire political leaders publicly signaling that they want a Democratic Party that stands for something and stands for something big, stands for something populist, is definitely politically significant. I mean, what significance did you take from it?
Well, I mean, what people I don't think fully understand, and particularly in a state like Iowa where there's caucuses, right? I mean, you've got people who are entering into these caucuses with a very specific agenda, with an agenda that has been sort of whipped already and has been organized, and it's outside of who the candidates are. So you're going to have people in these caucus rooms who are going to be arguing these points. I mean, this is not ephemeral. This is really very practical, particularly, you know, when you're talking about Iowa, because it's, you know, people are just on the ground and they're in a room and they're just talking about stuff. And to arm certain people with a specific agenda and people who have committed to carry this agenda out, this has got to, and of course, the operatives of all the campaigns are going to be aware that this is happening. And so they have to get their candidate to play to this agenda. I mean, that's really what the end game here is, right? And you know, we had a vote in the House in the Senate about a month ago, maybe a little bit less, 3 or 4 weeks ago, maybe it's even 2 weeks, I can't remember, on expanding Social Security that has a sort of the same, has a similar feel to it in terms of it sets down mile markers and people get judged against those mile markers.
Absolutely. Yeah. So at the time of this airing, it will be, you know, about 2 weeks ago. And, you know, this is just one more data point of many data points of how Elizabeth Warren is fundamentally changing the national conversation. You know, the fact that she got Joe Manchin from West Virginia to partner with her on an expand Social Security resolution, and to get the number of people in the Senate who are on the record for expanding benefits from 5 to 42 literally overnight, making it the consensus position among the Democratic caucus in the Senate, is just huge. It's a game changer in the national conversation. And likewise, in the House, a strong majority of House members are now publicly on the record for expansion. This is no longer just the tip of the spear. This is the consensus majority viewpoint in the Democratic Party. And, you know, we really need a Democratic nominee that is, you know, out there on these issues. And just for anybody who's listening to this saying, wait, we can't lose the White House, we shouldn't be too liberal, you know, the key thing to know here is that these are not, quote-unquote, liberal positions compared to where the country is. This is where the center of the country is. The Progressive Change Institute, our sister organization, did polling on this. Expanding Social Security benefits is popular by 70% to 15%. That's Republican, Democrat, independent voters. Debt-free college at all public universities is 71% to 19%. Right? So these are huge winners if we campaign on them. And especially as people like Mitt Romney and Ted Cruz are out there talking about poverty and talking about income inequality, you know, only talking the talk, completely being fakers. We need a Democratic Party that walks the walk, that actually has a plan and is showing that we're the real deal. Because now, even the Republicans know this is where the country is. We just need to show that we're the real proponents of this.
Now, I will say this. There's probably very few people who are listening to this who are going to say that these positions are too liberal, and if only because they have heard the polling ad nauseum on this program. But with that said, just explain a little bit how the mechanics work. I mean, I think there are people who would say, like, look, it's a non-binding resolution. So what? They voted for this. Just walk us down, like, you know, how this ends up making a difference down the road. Obviously, it's not going to change overnight. But just take us through that process of how this vote makes it easier for people to run on in the future, and obviously the legislation getting done because people have run on it.
Sure. And first, just to clarify, my assumption was that by the time of this airing, you have already been on Marc Maron's podcast and his TV show, and therefore there's just a swath of new listeners who are joining. Is that a fair assumption?
That was a fair assumption. Okay. However, it's probably going to be we're only going to be days away from airing this, and though I have both taped and recorded those two programs, I don't think they're going to air for another month or two.
My other assumption is that they will be so enthused that they will actually go back and listen to old episodes of the Majority Report, and therefore they just need to hear this important polling information.
All right, fair enough. Touche.
to your point, and this is kind of where I put my organizer's hat and think about, okay, how does this actually move what functionally gets done? You know, rewind 3 years, no politician was putting the idea of expanding Social Security benefits in their poll, right, of their local district or state as they seek to shine a spotlight on certain issues and run on those issues, right? The poll is usually a step that leads to a decision about what an entire campaign story arc, including potentially millions of dollars in TV ads, are, you know, run on. You know, last cycle, for the first time, after we and others worked together with each other and with Elizabeth Warren and others in the Senate to make this a credible issue by the end of 2013, you know, we saw for the first time politicians polling on it, actively running TV ads or direct mail pieces, putting real money behind this expanded Social Security message. And in key primaries, like the big Hawaii Senate race with Brian Schatz, a key progressive Democrat versus corporate Democrat primary with Mike Honda in California, as well as Bonnie Watson Coleman in New Jersey, we had 3 out of 3 people who actively campaigned on this issue and won on this issue in their primaries. And what we want in 2016 is for this to, again, be the consensus Democratic position, not just the tip of the spear progressives, but everybody polling this. When they poll it, they will find this is popular. And if you think about the campaign as a multi-billion dollar conversation with voters, not just a way to kind of get across the finish line and then start governing, but a chance to take the country with us and set up the foundation for actually governing in 2017 and beyond. You know, politicians actively running TV ads on the idea that we must expand benefits is huge. You know, it also serves to marginalize the Simpson Bowles of the world. You know, I think we need to declare with one voice that the days of Simpson Bowles are over, the days of Warren Manchin are here, right? We need to be talking about expanding Social Security benefits and what that looks like and just not even acknowledging those who say we have to cut benefits. So, you know, this is how we change the conversation, and this is how we realign political incentives and realign what's possible in Congress.
I love it when you put that organizer hat on, because I think that you know, to have that sort of theory of change outlined in a very mechanical and practical way, I think it's very helpful for people, because it's very easy to become cynical about the value of what start as symbolic votes or symbolic stances. And the same theory applies with everything you're doing in the Ready for Boldness statement that people have signed on to, right? I mean, it's the same sort of incremental, and at one point, all of a sudden, it just gets a critical mass and starts to roll much faster process.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm very glad that we didn't just say run on big, bold economic populist ideas and leave it at that, and that, you know, instead we actively specified, you know, 5 or 6 big issues here. And, you know, kind of a secondary accomplishment of this is that there are people, you know, not just in Congress, but again, state legislators, city council people, town council people, local Democratic Party chairs, county, city, who are, you know, who have read the readyforboldness.com statement, decided to opt in, but in that decision really thought about the issues and said, do I agree with this? Yeah, I agree with that. Do I agree with it? Yeah, I haven't heard about that before, but that sounds wonderful. A national goal of debt-free college at public universities, the idea that, you know, just the principle in America that you should be able to go to college and on graduation day not have debt, that's a unifying force. It should be. And it's something that, again, was super popular in polling. We've been working the halls of Congress. There will actually be big news in the next couple of weeks in terms of a large coalition in Congress stepping out together behind that idea. I am very hopeful that the Clinton campaign and others during the course of 2016 will endorse that idea. And I hope that it's one of the centerpiece agenda items of the Democratic Party and just the national conversation in 2016. And it all begins by getting those ideas on the table. And that's what, you know, our resolution does. That's what this readyforboldness.com statement does, and similar vehicles like this.
The website is readyforboldness.com to check out the statement. Adam Green, co-founder of the PCCC, thanks so much for your time today.
Yep. Thank you, Sam. Take care.
Say to never pay.